You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. You are welcome to Book Lovers Cafe today. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we are going to definitely be talking about the Sound. We're talking to author David B. Williams. He has recently written Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound. David is a freelance writer. He lives in Seattle. He has a degree in geology, and he's worked for the National Park Service, I think in Colorado. His book has just been published by the University of Washington Press. I'd like to draw your attention, too, to some previous books. He wrote Waterway, A Story of Seattle's Locks and Ship Canal, Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography, and also Seattle Walks, and then also Stories in Stone about urban geology. Anyway, a fair number of books of high interest to people in our neighborhood. So, welcome, David. Thanks for stopping by phone today.
Chris, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me, and it's an honor to be part of your podcast with such an amazing group of authors you've interviewed.
Right. So, I'd like to start out for you to begin with your personal history. When did you begin to write, and especially about the places that you love? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I have long been interested in place, and it really began when I was living in southern Utah and had spent a lot of time out there teaching about the natural history, working for the Park Service, and decided to try and put together a book about plants, animals, and geology. I wanted to write a book that was centered on a place that I lived and that I knew, and so ended up doing that book, and then ended up moving to Seattle, back to Seattle where I grew up about 25 years ago, and decided to try and think about that relationship between people and place. When I worked for the Park Service, I was always interested that people ask questions about the plants, the animals, and the geology. And I always encouraged them to ask those same questions when they got back home, because the answers were always going to be as interesting as any in a national park. So when I moved back to Seattle, I actually paid attention to what I'd said and started doing that. And that led to my first book, The Seattle Street Smart Naturalist, a series of questions that a naturalist would answer or ask. And then over time, I've just continued to explore that subject through a variety of books, always interested in what is the relationship between people and place? How do we influence landscape? How does landscape influence us, which ultimately then led to the writing of Home Waters.
Right. Home Waters, it's right in front of us, yet we can just take it for granted, that beautiful Puget Sound. So let's start with the coastal Salish, you know, the place itself before we came. And tell us a little bit about why you decided to write about this, you know, Puget Sound south of Port Townsend. You put it there.
Yeah, interesting. One of the things when I started thinking about the idea of Puget Sound was, what is Puget Sound? What are the geographic boundaries? And talking to oceanographers in particular, really came to this belief that it is the area south of Port Townsend, because the water changes, how water moves through the landscape changes because of a big sill in Admiralty Inlet that affects that movement and flow of water. So that, one, was an oceanographic issue, but two, I just think culturally that's how most people I talk to think of the Sound, as that area south down here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the Coast Salish people who lived here and have lived here for thousands of years and continue to live here, you know, that boundary didn't exist. They had a different relationship to place, and we've created boundaries, the 49th parallel. And so my stories also follow that idea that the natural history, the human history, of course, crosses in and out of Admiralty Inlet, goes into Canada, Puget Sound, Salish Sea. So I really wanted to think about not only that sort of tight landscape, but also the bigger landscape. So stories sort of telescope in and out through the book.
Yes, they do. It's really fascinating to read. Why don't you give us a little bit of a flavor of the book by reading?
That would be fun. So this comes from the introduction. In the summer of 2018, I grieved with millions of people around the world. Our collective sadness focused on a 20-year-old mother, Tilakwa, one of a dwindling number of orca who regularly visit Puget Sound. On July 24th, Tilakwa had given birth to her second child, a daughter, who died within 30 minutes. For the next 17 days, she carried the 6-foot-long body of her dead offspring on a journey of more than 1,000 miles. Finally, Tilakwa let her calf go. Our hearts broke. Then, 2 years later, September 6, 2020, it was with much joy that whale researchers announced Tilakwa had given birth 2 days earlier. A healthy and precocious boy calf, dubbed J57, was born in the Strait of Juan de Fuca after an 18-month gestation. Researchers have high hopes the baby will survive. To paraphrase Emily Dickinson, hope is a baby orca in Puget Sound. Mourning the loss of a child is a natural response for humans and orca. Both species are smart, self-aware, and deeply connected to their families. Clearly, Tilakwa, like us, had loved her daughter and did not want to part from her. And, as we learned, her extended family tried to help by providing food for the grieving mother. Ecologists suggested that they might also have been mourning with her. Tilakwa and her family are members of a group of more than 70 orca known as the Southern Resident Killer Whales. These animals, which have evolved a culture and community unique to their home in Puget Sound, travel together, hunt together, and communicate using their own distinctive dialect. Solidifying their cultural affinity, the Southern residents also rely on the collective knowledge of their elders, particularly the matriarchs, who act as guides and teachers to their family members. Why shouldn't they also love and grieve together? And why shouldn't we also love and grieve with Tilakwa? Few animals are as sacred and iconic to Puget Sound residents as orca, or in more dire straits. Habitat loss, disturbance from noise and boat traffic, exposure to an ever-increasing toxic mixture of pollutants, and overfishing of their favorite food, salmon, have pushed the southern resident population to the point where their very survival in Puget Sound is in doubt. For many who followed Tilakwa, their grief for her was compounded by their grief for the environment of Puget Sound and the way its degradation affects orca and humans. If Tilakwa and her calf couldn't thrive, what did it mean for us? More than any other story, Tilakwa's loss crystallized the central environmental challenges of Puget Sound. The orca are suffering. The salmon are suffering. We are responsible. For most of my life, I have lived within a few miles of Puget Sound, the narrow inland sea between the Cascade and Olympic Mountains. I knew that I lived by troubled waters, but I did not fully grasp the magnitude of the crisis that had been rising around me, like the tide submerging a low island. Although I saw myself as someone deeply aware of my natural surroundings, I realized I simply hadn't paid close enough attention to a place I love and where I intend to reside for the rest of my life. I needed to take heed of all the people who had lived here, how they have related to the landscape over the millennia, and how their stories could provide a better understanding of the conditions now shaping the lives of modern residents. Furthermore, as a writer who is generally focused on stories about the land, I had not fully appreciated the water and those who dwell in it. Standing on the shoreline or riding a ferry and seeing only the surface of the water, which tends to appear untainted and beautiful, I had long failed to see the interconnected lives of the plants and animals beneath and to understand how they sustain and breathe life, both metaphorically and literally, in Puget Sound. The effects of human activity, overfishing, pollution, and climate change reach deep beneath that surface. Our actions, their lives, our lives. We cannot cut one strand without unraveling the many connections that link us. This book, then, is my hope, my way to rectify my lack of understanding of the cultural and ecological history of my home waters and to provide a resource for others. That's it.
Thank you, David. You are listening to David B. Williams, and he was reading from his book, Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound. So we talked a little bit about the family of the orcas that we have really changed our whole perspective of thinking of them as a family. And But there were the other families that were here before the European settlers, and that was the Coastal Salish. Can you paint us a picture of what it was like? You mentioned a settlement called Bear Creek.
Yeah. So one of the things about the story that one of the things I wanted to do with this book was to not tell I think what is often the standard story that George Vancouver discovered Puget Sound in 1792, when we know people have been living here for thousands of years. The earliest evidence comes from a spot in Redmond called Bear Creek down by Seattle. It dates back more than 12,500 years. And at the site, there have been numerous projectile points and stone tools were found there. And so we know that people have continuously lived here and adapted to that landscape over time. The early arrivals arrived in a very different looking landscape than we have, a much more open landscape. It wasn't really till about 5,000 years ago that we start to see the forests that we all know here, that those classic forests of Douglas fir and cedar and hemlock. And the people who lived here, again, obviously continue to live here, adapted to that, developing a lifestyle that was very much moving with the food resources, taking advantage of the resources, not only in the sea, but also on the land, and living here in a way. And one of the things that I came across was this, looking at how people use the resources, and they use them sustainably for thousands of years. And that to me is, and to others, is very much an inspiration as a way to think about our relationship of being, of having a much more sustainable relationship to the natural resources of the Sound.
So true. Many people, when they first arrive to this part of the world, they love our state parks. And then they realize that our state parks are really used to be military forts. Why are there so many military forts in such a small area? And of course, I'm thinking of Fort Worden and Fort Flagler and Fort Casey.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are amazing. And that was really also one of the genesises for the book, was going to those places and wondering exactly what is the story with that? And it dates back to the earliest time that settlers were in Seattle, and in Puget Sound, of trying to think about their relationship and thinking, wow, this is a place that we want protection. We want to be able to defend it. And it took basically 50, 60 years from first European settlement to getting to the point where the United States government was willing to provide the money to build those forts. And it was out of a sort of a big nationwide project and change of defending ports. And we got the Triangle of Fire, the three forts that you mentioned. And the idea being is that if you could build on either side of Admiralty Inlet and defend it, then no one could come down. And the initial was mostly worried about the British coming down and taking over. And it's the irony is that the British, at the same time that we were building our forts, was looking at the expansion of America and going, how do we protect our places? How do we protect our spots in British Columbia? So it was an interesting mix. And those forts were never used as they were intended to protect this area, which is great. Much better that forts are never used and are really just an insurance policy. And then over time, as they become basically useless, if you will, from a military point of view, we then are lucky enough to have them as now as state parks.
You did say in the book that by the time that they built them, they were already obsolete in terms of protection. So, we're all very thankful that now we have beautiful places to walk and explore and sing in the batteries with the echoing walls.
Yes.
So,
you don't want me to do that.
Right. And then, you think about, you mentioned the Native people and going and how they traveled around. And there were many tribal groups in different places. Talk about the transportation and the Native mode of transportation to both get food and also visit and trade. I thought that was fascinating in your book.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to be able to speak with a variety of tribal people who really helped me understand this story a little bit better. And from what I was able to gather from them and other research is this idea of canoe culture. Again, it probably started 5,000 years ago. It probably goes back deeper, but we don't know for sure. But 5,000 years ago, we start to see cedar come in and the canoes become central. And they were the, you know, just this amazing system. You could go anywhere in a canoe. And these canoes were beautifully designed, beautifully built out of single trees. They would be used to ferry people, to ferry goods, to be used for hunting. There were canoes that were designed specifically for being out on the sound. There were canoes that were designed for bigger, more ocean-type going for war purposes. There were canoes designed to be used in on the rivers. So this culture really permeated the region and then changed, as things often do, when European settlers come in. We start to see sailing vessels, we start to see steamships. But then there's also been this amazing revival of canoe culture with the canoe journeys. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to see one. And just to experience what was clearly the joy and pride of the people paddling in, and really this view that it struck me as this is what it was like for thousands of years, people gathering together, sharing stories, sharing food, sharing connections and relationships. And it would to see one of the canoe journeys is really a magical experience.
That's right. Occasionally they do on their route, they come by Port Townsend. So we've had that opportunity.
Oh, great.
And we've also hear a lot about the mosquito fleet here in Port Townsend. And the mosquito fleet and, you know, the fact that not only do we have a lot of forts, but we have a lot of docks, you know. So
yeah.
Wow, these docks, they were all used. And then, so are there any left? Are there any boats of the mosquito fleet still in existence?
Yeah, so the mosquito fleet was this armada of steamers ranging in size from the smallest I found was about 20 feet long to one that was 300 feet long. And they went, again, like the canoes, they went everywhere in Puget Sound. And there were hundreds of these over starting in the 1860s up all the way through the early 1900s. And yeah, I mean, the idea of the docks is really important. I've tracked down a list, put together a list of a quote unquote official mosquito fleet dock or stops, and there were more than 300 in Puget Sound. So exactly what you said, Chris, this idea of these docks going out into the water, and I think there are many still left, and we see, I know I've been out on the Sound and seen just pilings going out into the water, and it's like, what is that? And that was probably a mosquito fleet dock, because people could live anywhere in the Sound, and they did. One of the mosquito fleet boats would come by, they'd flag it down, or it was a scheduled stop. They could load their goods. It was sort of like a bank, a traveling general store, a UPS truck, a good place to get gossip. And you could live anywhere and still stay connected to the Sound. And I think that's a central element of the Sound, of the water, is it's allowed people to move across and through this waterway and really knit it together into a community. Mm-hmm. And I think the boat story is really central to that.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, we kind of got a more traditional and scheduled ferry system. And you mentioned a woman named Marcia Morse. And tell us a little bit about her and her life on the ferries.
Yeah, Marcia has worked for the Washington State Department of Transportation for the ferry system for decades, and really has basically sort of been on every route, done every job. She's now a captain and has been that way for many years. And I was lucky enough to ride with her back and forth on one of the routes and chat with her for a bit. And she made this very profound statement to me. She said, I grew up in Eastern Washington, and I was used to these sort of big views of the landscape. And she said, when I'm out on a ferry, I have that now. This is the one of the places where you can get the big views as opposed to, say, hiking in the forest. And she said, there's this spiritual aspect to riding the ferries. And she said, even though I've been doing it for decades, I still always try and stop in the at some point when I'm out on the water and look up and notice this amazing beauty that we have around us. And so to me, this idea that the ferries that we think of as very sort of utilitarian, you drive, you get stuck in a I can describe it as a regularly scheduled traffic jam as you wait to get on the ferry. You get on and you continue on your way. But I think for many of us, that spiritual aspect, that connecting to place through the ferries, is really important. And her observation, it's in part because of those big views, really make it, again, fitting into that long story of the Sound as a maritime highway.
Right. This past year's been difficult when they tell you to stay in your car down below, you know, because that's true. I always try to take advantage of the fact to just look out the window and be quiet and you know, be happy that I'm on a ferry like that. And she was, you asked her about a pickle fork, and I just wanted to bring that up. Just exactly what is the pickle fork?
What is the pickle fork? Yeah, my favorite term I learned, I think, in the entire book. It's the spot on the ferry, the two little prongs that stick out. It's usually where if you're on a ferry and you come in on the upper deck, a passenger's come in on that upper deck, and that little part that sticks out above the auto deck, those are called the pickle forks because they look a little bit like the tines of a fork. Mm-hmm. So if you want to impress your friends at your next Zoom cocktail event, mention a pickle fork.
Or say, let's go out on the pickle fork and take
exactly.
a look around. Good place to watch. Good place to watch for whales. The next thing I wanted to ask you about was thinking about my early walks on the beach. And just the first thing you notice is the big, the big bulbous, huge ropes of kelp that children love to pick up and swing around. What is the kelp forest here in the Puget Sound?
Yeah, the kelp forests are really the underwater equivalent of the temperate rainforests here. And we all know the temperate rainforests, the importance of them to the terrestrial ecosystem. Well, the kelp forest underwater, which is primarily the tallest part of it, are the bull kelp, the ones that you described, the big bulb and that long strand on the beach. But there are also many other species. There are 18 or 19 species of kelp in Puget Sound. And that forest acts as a nursery. It acts as a feeding ground. It acts as a safe haven for so many different species, invertebrates, fish. They're all relying on that. And it's arguably probably one of the most important parts of the ecosystem, and also because there's providing a lot of carbon and a lot of nutrients to animals. And I think many people have become aware that the forests grow on salmon. As salmon come up, die, get eaten by all sorts of animals, those animals go in the forest, they poop out the nutrients. Same thing with kelp forests, that those nutrients are circulated throughout the ecosystem. So it is central to the health of Puget Sound is a healthy kelp
mm-hmm.
forest.
Mm-hmm. And we've got kelp renewal project here outside the Maritime Center and Maritime Science Center and you know that place here in Port Townsend helps people become aware of the life that's right there, right in front of us. And in your chapter, The Silver Wave, we all know about the salmon, but we don't think about some of the other species that are so important to the health of the Sound, especially the rockfish. I just didn't know about rockfish. So tell us about the importance of the rockfish in the ecosystem.
The rockfish was a fun story for me. I didn't know much about them. And when I worked on thinking about the book, I spent about 5 or 6 months interviewing scientists to come up with ideas And they kept mentioning rockfish. And this is this group of fish. There's, I think, 28 species in the single genus of Sebastis, which means magnificent, which is such a great name. And they're found throughout the Sound, particularly as bottom dwellers in the Sound. And what there's some amazing aspects about them, and probably the one that people often get most excited about is the fact that there are rockfish in Puget Sound that could live for 200 years, which is just astounding to think about fish living that long, and many species that live for over 100 years. And they often would hang out down at the bottom and then hunker down. Sadly, we have often overfished them, and so their populations have dropped. Two of them are on the endangered species list. And for me, what was important about them is, one, just as a symbol of the Sound and how we have treated it and the possibility that they can be restored. We've seen this out on the coast with groups of rockfish that have, when we treated them with more of a manner of stewardship and sustainability, the species can bounce back. So it was really a symbolic of a species that is found throughout, is beautiful, overlooked, and yet essential to the story too.
Right. They come in so many different colors, and they're kind of like beautiful, wonderful ugliness kind of things.
Yes.
It's like they're just
yes.
fabulous. So the future of the Puget Sound, we know that there's some real problems, and there's some things that we are really worrying about. But what do you see about the hopefulness of what's going on now here in our neighborhood?
Yeah, I think it's two parts. One is the sort of, again, the long-term story that when European settlers arrived in the Sound, they saw the Sound as a natural resource to exploit, whether it was the trees or the fish. And so there was a lot of this degradation of the Sound. But I would argue, and I'm not alone in doing this, I know you've talked to Linda Mapes, who also writes about this, the idea that the Sound is probably in better health now than it's been for many, many decades. Not to say that it's perfect and we have a long ways to go, but it's in better health in part, and this is the second part of the story, is that we've come to understand it better, and people are now thinking of it in terms of stewardship, in terms of sustainability. And we see that not only with scientists who are studying it, helping us to understand the interconnections, the fact that we need to be concerned about kelp, we need to be concerned about herring, we need to be concerned about rockfish, not just salmon and orca. They're all interrelated.
They are.
Then there's also the group of people who are working on restoration. And we're seeing groups like the Puget Sound Restoration Fund that is, you know, actively helping the reintroduction of Olympia oysters, our native oysters, actively working on kelp. And exactly as you said with the museum up there, people are working and entities are working to protect it. So I think there's this collective aspect of the people here of wanting to protect this place, to have sustainability.
Thank you so much, David, for reminding us of that. And I'd like to say that you've been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and we've been talking to David Williams, author of Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound. Please join us next time for another talk with another author. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.
On the Black Ball Ferry Line, up in Seattle, where the sunshine seldom shines, up in Seattle, all the whistles go, and the bells go, and the ferry boats are chugging right along, right along.
All the people love to ride the Blue Pacific on the Black Ball Ferry Line to the Pacific,
while the whistles go, and the bells go,
and the ferry boats are chugging right along, right along.
Up on the upper deck, the view is great by heck. You love your gal effect, and you're in clover. And when the whistle